Cassette 3, Side 2. Sabashii was located on the western side of a 5-kilometer-high prominence called the Tarina Massif, south of Jarry de Loge crater in the ancient highlands between Isidis and Hellas, centered at longitude 275 degrees, latitude 15 degrees south. A reasonable choice for a tent town site, as it had long views to the west and low hills backing it to the east like moors. But when it came to living in the open air or growing plants out in the rocky countryside, it was a bit high. In fact, it was, if you excluded the very much larger bulges of Tharsis and Elysium, the highest region on Mars, a kind of bioregion island which the Sabashians had been cultivating for decades. They proved to be severely disappointed by the loss of the big mirrors, one might even say thrown into emergency mode, an all-out effort to do what they could to protect the plants of the biome. But it was precious little. Sax's old colleague, Nanao Nakayama, shook his head. Winter kill will be very bad, like Ice Age. I'm hoping we can compensate for the loss of light, Sax said. Thicken the atmosphere, add greenhouse gases. It's possible we could do some of that with more bacteria and Sir Alpine plants, right? Some, Nano said dubiously. A lot of niches are already full. The niches are quite small. They settled in over a meal to talk about it. All the texts from Da Vinci were there in the big dining hall of the Claw, and many Sabashians were there to greet them. It was a long, interesting, friendly talk. The Sabashians were living in the mound maze of their mohole, behind one talon of the dragon figure it made, so that they didn't have to look at the burned ruins of their city when they weren't working on it. The rebuilding was much reduced now, as most of them were out dealing with the results of the mirror loss. Nano said to Tariki, in what was clearly the continuation of a long-standing argument, It makes no sense to rebuild it as a tent city anyway. We might as well wait and build it in open air. That may be a long wait, Tariki said, glancing at Sax. We're near the top of the viability atmosphere named in the Dorsa Brevia document. Nano looked at Sax. We want Sabashii under any limit that is set. Sax nodded, shrugged. He didn't know what to say. The Reds wouldn't like it. But if the viable altitude limit was raised a kilometer or so, it would give the Sabashians this massif and make little difference on the larger bulges, so it seemed to make sense. But who knew what they would decide on Pavonis? He said, Maybe we should focus now on trying to keep atmospheric pressures from dropping. They looked somber. Sax said, You'll take us out and show us the massif? They cheered up.
Most happy.
The land of the Tarina Massif was what the areologists in the early years had called the dissected unit of the southern highlands, which was much the same as the cratered unit, but further broken by small channel networks. The lower and more typical highlands surrounding the massif also contained areas of ridged unit and hilly unit. In fact, as quickly became obvious the morning they drove out onto the land, all aspects of the rough terrain of the southern highlands were on view, often all at once. Cratered, broken, uneven, ridged, dissected, and hilly land, the quintessential Noachian landscape. Sax and Nanao and Tariki sat on the observation deck of one of the Sabashii University rovers. They could see other cars carrying other colleagues, and there were teams out walking ahead of them. On the last hills before the horizon to the east, a few energetic people were fell running. The hollows of the land were all lightly dusted with dirty snow. The massif was centered 15 degrees south of the equator, and they got a fair bit of precipitation around Sabashii, Nanao said. The southeast side of the massif was drier, but here the cloud masses pushed south over the ice in Isidis Planitia and climbed the slope and dropped their loads. Indeed, as they drove uphill, great waves of dark cloud rolled in from the northwest, pouring over them as if chasing the fell runners. Sack shuddered, remembering his recent exposure to the elements. He was happy to be in a rover, and felt he would need only short walks away from it to be satisfied. Eventually, however, they stopped on a high point in a low, old ridge and got out. They made their way over a surface littered with boulders and knobs, cracks, sand drifts, very small craters, bread-loafed bedrock, scarps and oases, and the old shallow channels that gave the dissected unit its name. In truth, there were deformational features of every kind to be seen, for the land here was 4 billion years old. A lot had happened to it, but nothing had ever happened to destroy it completely and clean the slate, so all 4 billion years were still there to be seen in a veritable museum of rockscapes. It had been thoroughly pulverized in the Noachian, leaving regoliths several kilometers deep and craters and deformities that no Aeolian stripping could remove. And during this early period, the other side of the planet had had its lithosphere to a depth of 6 kilometers blasted into space by the so-called Big Hit. A fair amount of that ejecta had eventually landed in the south. That was the explanation for the great escarpment and the lack of ancient highlands in the north. And one more factor in the extremely disordered look of this land. Then also, at the end of the Hesperian, had come the brief warm wet period, when water had occasionally run on the surface. These days most aerologists thought that this period had been quite wet, but not really very warm, annual averages of well under 273 degrees Kelvin, still allowing for surface water sometimes, replenished by hydrothermal convection rather than precipitation. This period had lasted for only 100 million years or so, according to current estimates, and it had been followed by billions of years of winds in the arid, cold Amazonian age, which had lasted right up to the point of their arrival. Is there a name for the age starting with M1? Sax asked. The Holocene. And then, lastly, everything had been scoured by 2 billion years of ceaseless wind, scoured so hard that the older craters were completely rimless, everything stripped at by the relentless winds strata by strata, leaving behind a wilderness of rock. Not chaos, technically speaking, but wild, speaking its unimaginable age in polyglot profusion, in rimless craters and etched mesas, dips, hummocks, escarpments, and, oh, so many blocky pitted rocks. Often they stopped the rover and walked around. Even small mesas seemed to tower over them. Sax found himself staying near their rover, but nevertheless he came upon all kinds of interesting features. Once he discovered a rover-shaped rock, cracked vertically all the way through. To the left of the block, off to the west, he had a view to a distant horizon, the rocky land out there a smooth yellow glaze. To the right, the waist-high wall of some old fault, pocked as if by cuneiform. Then a sand drift bordered by ankle-high rocks, some of them pyramidal dark basaltic ventifacts, others lighter pitted granulated rocks. There a balanced shatter cone, big as any dolmen. There a sandtail. There a crude circle of ejecta, like an almost completely weathered Stonehenge. There a deep snake-shaped hollow, the fragment of a watercourse, perhaps. Behind it another gentle rise, then a distant prominence like a lion's head. The prominence next to it was like the lion's body. In the midst of all this stone and sand, plant life was unobtrusive, at least at first. One had to look for it, to pay close attention to color, above all else, to green. Green in all its shades, but especially its desert shades, sage, olive, khaki, and so on. Nano and Tariki kept pointing out specimens he hadn't seen. Closer he looked, and closer again. Once attuned to the pale living colors which blended so well with the ferric land, they began to jump out from the rust and brown and umber and ochre and black of the rockscape. Hollows and cracks were likely places to see them, and near the shaded patches of snow. The closer he looked, the more he saw. And then in one high basin it seemed there were plants tucked everywhere. In that moment he understood. It was all Fellfield, the whole Tarina Massif. Then, coating entire rock faces, or covering the inside areas of drip catchments, were the day-glow greens of certain lichens and the emerald or dark velvet greens of the mosses, wet fur. The diversicolored palette of the lichen array, the dark green of pine needles, bunched sprays of Hokkaido pines, foxtail pines, Sierra junipers, life's colors. It was somewhat like walking from one great roofless room to another, over ruined walls of stone. A small plaza, a kind of winding gallery, a vast ballroom, a number of tiny interlocked chambers, a sitting room. Some rooms held Krumholtz bonsai against their low walls, the trees no higher than their nooks, gnarled by wind, cut along the top at snow level. Each branch, each plant, each open room, as shaped as any bonsai, and yet effortless. Actually, Nanao told him, most of the basins were intensively cultivated. This basin was planted by Abraham. Each little region was the responsibility of a certain gardener or gardening group. Ah, Sack said. And fertilized then? Tariki laughed. In a manner of speaking. The soil itself has been imported, for the most part. I see. This explained the diversity of plants. A little bit of cultivation, he knew, had been done around Arena Glacier, where he had first encountered the Fellfields. But here they had gone far beyond those early steps. Labs in Sabashii, Tariki told them, were trying their best to manufacture topsoil. A good idea. Soil in Fellfields appeared naturally at a rate of only a few centimeters a century, but there were reasons for this, and manufacturing soil was proving to be extremely difficult. Still, we pick up a few million years at the start, Nanao said. Evolve from there. They hand-planted many of their specimens, it seemed, then for the most part left them to their fate and watched what developed. I see, Sack said. He looked more closely yet. The clear, dim light. It was true that each great open room displayed a slightly different array of species. These are gardens, then? Yes, or things like that. Depends. Some of the gardeners, Nanao said, worked according to the precepts of Muso Soseki, others according to other Japanese Zen masters. Others still to Fu Shi, the legendary inventor of the Chinese system of geomancy called Feng Shui. Others to Persian gardening gurus, including Omar Khayyam, or to Leopold or Jackson, or other early American ecologists, like the nearly forgotten biologist Oscar Schnelling, and so on. These were influences only, Tariki added. As they did the work, they developed visions of their own. They followed the inclination of the land as they saw that some plants prospered and others died. Coevolution, a kind of epigenetic development. Nice, Sack said, looking around. For the adepts, the walk from Sabashii up onto the Massif must have been an aesthetic journey, filled with illusions and subtle variants of tradition that were invisible to him. Hiroko would have called it aerioformation, or the aerophony. I'd like to visit your soil labs. Of course. They returned to the rover, drove on. Late in the day, under dark, threatening clouds, they came to the very top of the massif, which turned out to be a kind of broad, undulating moor. Small ravines were filled with pine needles, sheared off by winds so that they looked like the blades of grass on a well-mowed yard. Sax and Tariki and Nanao again got out of the car, walked around. The wind cut through their suits, and the late afternoon sun broke out from under the dark cloud cover, casting their shadows all the way out to the horizon. Up here on the moors, there were many big masses of smooth, bare bedrock. Looking around, the landscape had the red primal look Sax remembered from the earliest years, but then they would walk to the edge of a small ravine and suddenly be looking down into green. Tariki and Nano talked about ecopoiesis, which for them was terraforming, redefined, subtleized, localized. Transmuted into something like Hiroko's aerial formation. No longer powered by heavy industrial global methods, but by the slow, steady, and intensely local process of working on individual patches of land. Mars is all a garden. Earth, too, for that matter. This is what humans have become. So we have to think about gardening, about that level of responsibility to the land, a human-Mars interface that does justice to both. Sax waggled a hand uncertainly. I'm used to thinking of Mars as a kind of wilderness, he said, as he looked up the etymology of the word garden. French, Teutonic, Old Norse, guard, enclosure, seemed to share origins with guard or keeping. But who knew what the supposedly equivalent word in Japanese meant? Etymology was hard enough without translation thrown into the mix. You know, get things started, let loose the seeds, then watch it all develop on its own. Self-organizing ecologies, you know. Yes, Tariki said, but wilderness, too, is a garden now. A kind of garden. That's what it means to be what we are. He shrugged, his forehead wrinkled. He believed the idea was true, but didn't seem to like it. Anyway, ecopoiesis is closer to your vision of wilderness than industrial terraforming ever was. Maybe, Sax said. Maybe they're just two stages of a process, both necessary. Tariki nodded, willing to consider it. And now? It depends on how we want to deal with the possibility of an ice age, Sax said. If it's bad enough, kills off enough plants, then ecopoiesis won't have a chance. The atmosphere could freeze back onto the surface, the whole process crash. Without the mirrors, I'm not confident that the biosphere is robust enough to continue growing. That's why I want to see those soil labs you have. It may be that industrial work on the atmosphere remains to be done. We'll have to try some modeling and see. Tariki nodded, and Nano, too. Their ecologies were being snowed under right before their eyes. Flakes drifted down through the transient bronze sunlight at this very moment, tumbling in the wind. They were open to suggestion. Meanwhile, as throughout these drives, their young associates from Da Vinci and Sabashii were running over the massif together and returning to Sabashii's mound maze, babbling through the night about geomancy and aeromancy, ecopoetics, heat exchange, the five elements, greenhouse gases, and so on. A creative ferment that looked to Sax very promising. Michel should be here, he said to Nano. John should be here. How he would love a group like this. And then it occurred to him. Anne should be here. So he went back to Pavonis, leaving the group in Sabashii talking things over. Back on Pavonis, everything was the same. More and more people, spurred on by Art Randolph, were proposing that they hold a constitutional congress. Write an at least provisional constitution, hold a vote on it, then establish the government described. Good idea, Sax said. Perhaps a delegation to Earth as well. Casting seeds. It was just like on the moors. Some would sprout, others wouldn't. He went looking for Anne, but found she had left Pavonis. Gone, people said, to a red outpost in Tempe Terra, north of Tharsis. No one went there but Reds, they said. After some thought, Sax asked for Steve's help and looked up the outpost's location. Then he borrowed a little plane from the Bogdanovists and flew north, past Ascrius Mons on his left, then down Ekkis Chasma and past his old headquarters at Ekkis Overlook on top of the huge wall to his right. Anne, too, had no doubt flown this route, and thus gone by the first headquarters of the terraforming effort. Terraforming. There was evolution in everything, even in ideas. Had Anne noticed Ekkis Overlook? Had she even remembered that small beginning? No way of telling. That was how humans knew each other. Tiny fractions of their lives intersected or were known in any way to anybody else. It was much like living alone in the universe, which was strange. A justification for living with friends, for marrying, for sharing rooms and lives as much as possible. Not that this made people truly intimate, but it reduced the sensation of solitude. So that one was still sailing solo through the oceans of the world, as in Mary Shelley's The Last Man, a book that had much impressed Sachs as a youth, in which the eponymous hero at the conclusion occasionally saw a sail, joined another ship, anchored against a shore, shared a meal, then voyaged on, alone and solitary. An image of their lives. For every world was as empty as the one Mary Shelley had imagined, as empty as Mars had been in the beginning. He flew past the blackened curve of Cassay Vallis without noting it at all. The Reds had long ago hollowed out a rock the size of a city block in a promontory that served as the last dividing wedge in the intersection of two of the Tempe Fossa, just south of Parapelkin Crater. Windows under overhangs gave them a view over both of the bare straight canyons and the larger canyon they made after their confluence. Now all these fossae cut down what had become a coastal plateau. Mariotis and Tempe together formed a huge peninsula of ancient highlands, sticking far into the new ice sea. Sachs landed his little plane on the sandy strip on top of the promontory. From here the ice plains weren't visible, nor could he spot any vegetation, not a tree, not a flower, not even a patch of lichen. He wondered if they had somehow sterilized the canyons. Just primal rock with a dusting of frost. And nothing they could do about frost unless they wanted to tent these canyons to keep air out rather than in. Sachs said, startled at the idea. Two Reds let him in the locked door on the top of the promontory, and he descended stairs with them. The shelter appeared to be nearly empty. Just as well. It was nice only to have to withstand the cold gazes of two young women leading him through the rough-hewn rock galleries of the refuge, rather than a whole gang. Interesting to see Red aesthetics. Very spare, as might be expected. Not a plant to be seen, just different textures of rock. Rough walls, rougher ceilings contrasted to a polished basalt floor, and the glistening windows overlooking the canyons. They came to a cliffside gallery that looked like a natural cave, no straighter than the nearly Euclidean lines of the canyon below. There were mosaics inlaid into the back wall made of bits of colored stone, polished and set against each other without gaps, forming abstract patterns that seemed almost to represent something, if only he could focus properly on them. The floor was a stone parquet of onyx and alabaster, serpentine and bloodstone. The gallery went on and on, big, dusty. The whole complex somewhat disused, perhaps. Reds preferred their rovers, and places like this no doubt had been seen as unfortunate necessities. Hidden refuge, with windows shuttered, one could have walked down the canyons right past the place and not known it was there, and Sachs felt that this wasn't just to avoid the notice of the Unta, but also to be unobtrusive before the land itself, to melt into it. As Anne seemed to be trying to do, there in a stone window seat. Sachs stopped abruptly. Lost in his thoughts, he had almost run into her, just as an ignorant traveler might have run into the shelter. A chunk of rock, sitting there. He looked at her closely. She looked ill. One didn't see that much anymore, and the longer Sax looked at her, the more alarmed he became. She had told him once that she was no longer taking the longevity treatment. That had been some years before, and during the revolution she had burned like a flame. Now, with the Red Rebellion quelled, she was ash, gray flesh. It was an awful sight. She was somewhere around 150 years old, like all the first 100 left alive, and without the treatments, she would soon die. Well, strictly speaking, she was at the physiological equivalent of being 70 or so, depending on when she had last had the treatments, so not that bad. Perhaps Peter would know. But the longer one went between treatments, he had heard, the more problems cropped up, statistically speaking. It made sense. It was only wise to be prudent. But he couldn't say that to her. In fact, it was hard to think what he could say to her. Eventually, her gaze lifted. She recognized him and shuddered, her lip lifting like a trapped animal's. Then she looked away from him, grim, stone-faced, beyond anger, beyond hope. "I wanted to show you some of the Tirrenia Massif," he said lamely. She got up like a statue rising and left the room. Sax, feeling his joints creak with the pseudo-arthritic pain that so often accompanied his dealings with Anne, followed her. He was trailed in his turn by the two stern-looking young women. "I don't think she wants to talk to you," the taller one informed him. "Very astute of you," Sax said. Far down the gallery, Anne was standing before another window, spellbound or else too exhausted to move. Or part of her did want to talk. Sax stopped before her. "I want to get your impressions of it," he said. "Your suggestions for what we might do next. And I have some areological questions. Of course, it could be that strictly scientific questions aren't of interest to you anymore." She took a step toward him and struck him on the side of the face. He found himself slumped against the gallery wall, sitting on his butt. Anne was nowhere to be seen. He was being helped to his feet by the two young women, who clearly didn't know whether to cheer or groan. His whole body hurt, more even than his face, and his eyes were very hot, stinging slightly. It seemed he might cry before these two young idiots, who by trailing him were complicating everything enormously. With them around, he couldn't yell or plead. He couldn't go on his knees and say, "Anne, please forgive me." He couldn't. "Where did she go?" he managed to say. "She really, really doesn't want to talk to you," the tall one declared. "Maybe you should wait and try later," the other advised. "Oh, shut up," Sax said, suddenly feeling an irritation so vehement that it was like rage. "I suppose you would just let her stop taking the treatment and kill herself."
"It's her right," the tall one pontificated.
"Of course it is. I wasn't speaking of rights. I was speaking of how a friend should behave when someone is suicidal. Not a subject you are likely to know anything about. Now help me find her."
"You're no friend of hers."
"I most certainly am." He was on his feet. He staggered a little as he tried to walk in the direction he thought she had gone. One of the young women tried to take his elbow. He avoided the help and went on. There Anne was, in the distance, collapsed in a chair, in some kind of dining chamber, it seemed. He approached her, slowing like Apollo in Zeno's Paradox. She swiveled and glared at him. "It's you who abandoned science right from the start," she snarled. "So don't you give me that shit about not being interested in science." "True," Sax said. "It's true." He held out both hands. "But now I need advice, scientific advice. I want to learn. And I want to show you some things as well."
but after a moment's consideration, she was up and off again, right past him, so that he flinched despite himself. He hurried after her. Her gait was much longer than his, and she was moving fast so that he had to almost jog. His bones hurt. "Perhaps we could go out here," Sack suggested. "It doesn't matter where we go out."
"Because the whole planet is wrecked," she muttered.
"You must still go out for sunsets occasionally," Sax persisted. "I could join you for that, perhaps."
"No. Please, Anne."
She was a fast walker and enough taller than him that it was hard to keep up with her and talk as well. He was huffing and puffing, and his cheek still hurt.
"Please, Anne."
She didn't answer. She didn't slow down. Now they were walking down a hall between suites of living quarters, and Anne sped up to go through a doorway and slam the door behind her. Sax tried it. It was locked. Not, on the whole, a promising beginning. Hound and hind. Somehow he had to change things so that it was not a hunt, a pursuit. Nevertheless, "I huff, I puff, I blow your house down," he muttered. He blew at the door. But then the two young women were there, staring hard at him. One evening later that week, near sunset, he went down to the changing room and suited up. When Anne came in, he jumped several centimeters.
"I was just going out," he stammered.
"Is that okay with you?"
"It's a free country," she said heavily.
And they went out the lock together, into the land. The young women would have been amazed. He had to be very careful. Naturally, although he was out there with her to show to her the beauty of the new biosphere, it wouldn't do to mention plants, or snow, or clouds. One had to let things speak for themselves. This was perhaps true of all phenomena. Nothing could be spoken for. One could only walk over the land and let it speak for itself. Anne was not gregarious. She barely spoke to him. It was her usual route, he suspected as he followed her. He was being allowed to come along. It was perhaps permissible to ask questions. This was science. And Anne stopped often enough to look at rock formations up close. It made sense at those times to crouch beside her and, with a gesture or a word, ask what she was finding. They wore suits and helmets, even though the altitude was low enough to have allowed breathing with only the aid of a CO2 filter mask. Thus, conversations consisted of voices in the ear, as of old, asking questions. So he asked. And Anne would answer, sometimes in some detail. Tempe Terra was indeed the land of time, its basement material a surviving piece of the southern highlands, one of those lobes of it that stuck far into the northern plains, a survivor of the big hit. Then later Tempe had fractured extensively as the lithosphere was pushed up from below by the Tharsis Bulge to the south. These fractures included both the Mareotis Fossae and the Tempe Fossa surrounding them now. The spreading land had cracked enough to allow some latecomer volcanoes to emerge, spilling over the canyons. From one high ridge they saw a distant volcano like a black cone dropped from the sky. Then another, looking just like a meteor crater as far as Sax could see. Anne shook her head at this observation and pointed out lava flows and vents, features all visible once they were pointed out, but not at all obvious under a scree of later ejecta rubble and, one had to admit, a dusting of dirty snow, collecting like sand drifts in wind shelters, turning sand-colored in the sunset light. To see the landscape in its history, to read it like a text written by its own long past, that was Anne's vision, achieved by a century's close observation and study, and by her own native gift, her love for it. Something to behold, really. Something to marvel at. A kind of resource or treasure. A love beyond science, or something into the realm of Michel's mystical science. Alchemy. But alchemists wanted to change things, a kind of oracle, rather. A visionary, with a vision just as powerful as Hiroko's, really. Less obviously visionary, perhaps, less spectacular, less active. An acceptance of what was there. Love of rock, for rock's sake, for Mars's sake. The primal planet in all its sublime glory, red and rust, still as death. Dead. Altered through the years only by matter's chemical permutations, the immense slow life of geophysics. It was an odd concept. Abiologic life. But there it was, if one cared to see it, a kind of living, out there spinning, moving through the stars that burned, moving through the universe in its great systolic-diastolic movement, its one big breath, one might say. Sunset somehow made it easier to see that. Trying to see things Anne's way. Glancing furtively at his wrist pad behind her back. Stone, from Old English, stom. Cognates everywhere. Back to Proto-Indo-European, sty, a pebble. Rock, from medieval Latin, rocca. Origin unknown. A mass of stone. Sax abandoned the wrist pad and fell away into a kind of rock reverie, open and blank. Tabula rasa, to the point where apparently he didn't hear what Anne herself was saying to him, for she snorted and walked on. Abashed, he followed and steeled himself to ignore her displeasure and ask more questions. There seemed to be a lot of displeasure in Anne. In a way, this was reassuring. Lack of effect would have been a very bad sign, but she still seemed quite emotional, at least most of the time. Sometimes she focused on the rock so intently it was almost like watching her obsessed enthusiasm of old, and he was encouraged. Other times it seemed she was just going through the motions, doing areology in a desperate attempt to stave off the present moment, stave off history, or despair, or all of that. In those moments she was aimless and didn't stop to look at obviously interesting features they passed and didn't answer his questions about same. The little Sax had read about depression alarmed him. Not much could be done. One needed drugs to combat it, and even then nothing was sure. But to suggest antidepressants was more or less the same as suggesting the treatment itself, and so he could not speak of it. And besides, was despair the same as depression? Happily, in this context, plants were pitifully few. Tempe was not like Tirina, or even the banks of the Arena Glacier. Without active gardening, this was what one got. The world was still mostly rock. On the other hand, Tempe was low in altitude and humid, with the ice ocean just a few kilometers to the north and west, and various Johnny Appleseed flights had passed over the entire southern shoreline of the New Sea, part of Biotique's efforts begun some decades ago when Sax had been in Burrows. So there was some lichen to be seen, if you looked hard, and small patches of Fellfield, and a few Krumholtz trees half buried in snow. All these plants were in trouble in this northern summer-turned-winter, except for the lichen, of course. There was a fair bit of miniaturized fall color already, there in the tiny leaves of the ground-hugging conidia and pygmy buttercup and ice grass and, yes, Arctic saxifrage. The reddening leaves served as a kind of camouflage in the ambient red rock. Often Sax didn't see plants until he was about to step on them. And, of course, he didn't want to draw Anne's attention to them anyway, so when he did stumble on one, he gave it a quick evaluative glance and walked on. They climbed a prominent knoll overlooking the canyon west of the refuge, and there it was, the great ice sea, all orange and brass in the late light. It filled the lowland in a great sweep and formed its own smooth horizon from southwest to northeast. Mesas of the fretted terrain now stuck out of the ice like sea stacks or cliff-sided islands. In truth, this part of Tempe was going to be one of the most dramatic coastlines on Mars, with the lower ends of some fossae filling to become long fjords or lochs. And one coastal crater was right at sea level and had a break in its seaside, making it a perfect round bay some 15 kilometers across, with an entry channel about 2 kilometers across. Farther south, the fretted terrain at the foot of the Great Escarpment would create a veritable Hebrides of an archipelago, many of the islands visible from the cliffs of the mainland. Yes, a dramatic coastline, as one could see already looking at the broken sheets of sunset ice. But of course this was not to be noted. No mention at all of the ice, the jagged bergs jumbled on the new shoreline. The bergs had been formed by some process Sax wasn't aware of, though he was curious, but it couldn't be discussed. One could only stand in silence as if having stumbled into a cemetery.
This ends side 2 of cassette 3 of Blue Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 4.